We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror.
Everybody just do your job. You understand that?
Hey, will you shut up?
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee.
Alex, there's always a situation when I go out to the West Coast. I text somebody, you know, they do it right out here. This weekend, it was Portland on my way to Eugene for the Colorado Oregon game. And man, this is my second time in Portland. Man, they do it right out there. I gotta say, y'all, no, not they, y'all. You're a West Coaster now. Y'all do it right out there.
Portland's a good city. You get some Salt and Straw ice cream when you were up there?
No, but I have had it. I've had it before. I've had it in the past.
Pretty good ice cream.
The 7 o'clock games are over, or 8 o'clock games are over, is nice, man. Real nice.
So is the starting at 9. It's not bad. Although, how did you like podcasting with me at like 7 a.m. the other day?
That was fine, honestly. No, that was fine. Look, I'm awake. You know, that's not the worst thing in the world. But I really dug the Notre Dame Ohio State game ending, and it was like 8 o'clock.
Yeah, no, it's not bad. I have to give this to West Coasters in general. Like, I came out to Southern California, and a lot of people are like, the best thing here is watching sports. And I don't know that you would find it the same way, because you are a big English soccer fan.
A big soccer fan. Yeah,
and
that's tough.
That isn't great. You know, that's taking your 10 a.m.s and making them 7 a.m.s. But if you're up, you're up. And so there's a lot to be said for watching sports from this time zone, even though it sometimes means waking up earlier than you would want. I think it goes both ways.
Yeah. So and it's funny because like the crowd, like the student section was full at Oregon for what was a noon 12:30 kick because of, you know, and I was talking to some people at Oregon who were like, yeah, that student section is not typically full for a noon kickoff. But you know,
well, college students are college students. I mean, how many times is the student section not full at kickoff for like a big time SEC game that is being played at noon? Pretty frequently, because college students are college students, whether they are in Tuscaloosa or Baton Rouge or Austin or Austin, as opposed to Austin. See what I did there? Richard, I'm glad that you started with a little bit of Western talk, because this is an episode this week between you and me. Stephen Godfrey is out on business. I'm Alex Kirshner. This is Richard Johnson, about the season the Pac-12 is having. I think the great irony, the sad irony of the sport this year is that the Pac-12 might be the best conference in the country. When was the last time you could say that?
At least the most interesting.
It's certainly the most interesting, and I think it's certainly the deepest. It may not be the best at the top, but it's certainly the deepest and the most interesting.
Yes.
And I don't think that's been true since like the late aughts, maybe, like when you had, at the same time, you had like the last embers of Pete Carroll USC. You had Harbaugh at Stanford. You had good Oregon. Like, when was the last time the Pac-12 was even clipping the top of college football? It's been a minute, and it's happening right now at a moment when everyone except two schools has left the ship, and George Kliavkoff and the Pac-12 presidents have incompetently allowed this league to die on the vine, despite what is a really compelling football moment in this league. Everyone, including us, has talked at length about Colorado, but it's funny because on the field, that is only a peripheral Pac-12 story right now. It's only a peripheral Pac-12 contender, and I still think that could be, you know, anywhere from a 5 to an 8 win team. But then you look at the rest of this league. By the current SP Plus ratings, Washington is 4, USC is 5, Oregon is 6. UCLA is 17, Utah is 18. It's a forward-looking, not a backward-trailing metric, though it is disrespectful to the Utes, Bill.
Well, Yeah, but remember, some of it is still, there's some off-season kind of baked into some of these right
there
now.
There is. There's,
we're not all the way out of it.
No, preseason projections are still baked in pretty heavily. I'm not even sure that they're entirely phased out by the very end of the year. Oregon State 20, Wazoo 28, again, what we just said. Colorado is down at 79, and again, what we just said, because I think even Bill would tell you that early in the season, with a team that has an entirely new roster, SP Plus is going to struggle to figure them out.
It's going to miss.
Yeah. It's going to struggle to figure them out. Exactly. I don't think many people think that Colorado is only the 80th best team in the country, but there are still questions to answer about that team. So you could pretty easily
here's the thing. And it's funny. Like, where do you put them? Like, I don't even know that you can answer that question effectively until they kind of get through Saturday, right? Until they play USC and you're like, all right, I don't think last week was a fluke, but what happens this week sort of, because they're the team that you could put anywhere from 80 to 40, right?
Yeah.
Does that sound?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wide dispersion team, but in front of them, at least for now, are a full seven teams that I just ran off that you could look at and think, like that is at least a possible New Year's Six bowl team that we're looking at, or a playoff bowl team in most of those cases. And then also in this conference,
I think there's only three of those that are playoff.
Three or four. We'll see. I'm curious which three you're talking about. Okay. Which one of USC, Oregon, Utah, and Washington are you saying has no chance whatsoever?
Washington, USC, and Oregon are the playoff adjacent teams.
Not Utah.
Utah does not have enough offense.
Not right now. Well, and I know that we're going to get to it. Yeah.
Wait. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. But they don't have enough offense to get into a four-team playoff scenario.
Let's get into it. It's interesting. I want to first talk about why you think this, all of this, I'm making my hands really big here for the YouTube audience, is happening. It seems like when you have this many Pac-12 teams that are up at the same time, like there's got to be a through line, like a reason why this is happening. And I'm wondering what the first one is that you think about that has led to this kind of constellation of Western football teams being really good all at the same time for the first time in a very long time.
The obvious is the obvious, right? You got, they found ways finally to all, not just a couple, all hire great coaches and get the thing that you need to go from 0 to 60, which is great quarterback play. Like, and it's not just USC and Oregon have great quarterback play. It's, again, we're talking a six deep, seven deep, at least competent quarterback play, right? Now, I do think you've got some of these teams that have raised the floor on their line play considerably. I think Washington State and Oregon State, obvious. I think UCLA, fairly obvious there. Washington, the injury situation does not fill me with a ton of joy. I think we're going to get to it when they play probably Oregon here in 2 or 3 weeks. USC, Lincoln Riley's an obvious. And then Oregon, okay, you're good. Oregon had great line play when Mario was there, you know, Penny Sewell, et cetera. So you just found ways to get competent football into this league from a depth perspective. Sorry, that's what I mean.
I think what's interesting about the interplay between the coaching hires that this league has made and the quarterback play that these teams have gotten is that some of these were slam dunks, like, oh, congrats, you went and got Caleb Williams, you know, genius idea, right? Like, it's not that hard to figure out that you should do that. It's not that hard for...
But that wouldn't have happened if
they hadn't hired Lincoln. No, I agreed. But, you know, you could even talk about it from the perspective of it probably wasn't that much of a mystery for Chip that he should recruit Dante Moore, who has yet to bear fruit, but I think will.
And he inherited Dorian Thompson-Robinson, another five-star at, you know,
yeah,
at way the back time.
Home. Yeah. But what I think is interesting is that a lot of these quarterback recruitments in this league were evaluation and development jobs. Like, I think a lot about Michael Penix Jr. at Indiana. And it is now a common, I don't know that I would say trope, but a common line of thinking that Indiana letting Michael Penix get away is indicative of all that is wrong with that program and why it's dead-ending under Tom Allen and God hates Indiana football and all of that. And well, God
hates Indiana football. That's true.
But loves home field apparel, homefieldapparel.com. But I think that what that misses is that, like, by the end of Michael Penix Jr.'s time in Bloomington, he looked like a broken quarterback. Like a,
right.
Broken quarterback.
You had to get over the fact that there might be a ticking time bomb in his knee.
Yeah. Like, he was physically and production-wise completely broken by the time he rolled out of Indiana following the 2021 season, which had been a big regression on the previous two, one of which was obviously the COVID year. It wasn't, you know, as big a slam dunk as it might seem that Kalen DeBoer, who had been his coordinator in Indiana before going to Fresno and then getting the Washington job after Jimmy Lake's kind of one-year implosion in that gig, it wasn't a given that that was going to be a smart idea for Kalen DeBoer to undertake. I think the same is true, though it's not currently playing out, with Cam Rising being Utah's guy. Remember, he was a four-star recruit, went to Texas. Texas always has quarterbacks in the room, didn't play. How many like run-of-the-mill or even upper-tier four-stars transfer and are nothing at their new school? But Utah found a system that worked for them, that worked for Cam. I think you can tell a similar story right now about DJ Uiagalelei at Clemson. Last weekend against Oregon State was not his finest hour, but I think we are seeing a better version of DJ than we saw at Clemson.
Don't know that we are.
Interesting.
And we can go kind of in on that game if we want to, but when I watched that game, I saw and I see what Oregon State is trying to do. And I commend Oregon State for, and DJ to the extent that both are culpable here, for running more. I mean, one of the things that I was always pretty confused about at Clemson was why he didn't run more in both scramble and design quarterback run situations. It was clear on Saturday night that especially in the second half, that was the plan, and they executed that plan. I think that Oregon State's offense is tailor-made to help its quarterback out. We've sort of talked about how the play action off of a competent run game and the shot-taking ability down the field is going to be there, but you watch that game with the fine-tooth comb, and you see some of the misses. You see some of the layups. That, like, there were a couple, I think two or three, like fourth down short yard situations where you just missed. And that's indicative of some of the same stuff that you saw with erratic accuracy at Clemson, while still understanding that I do think Oregon State has raised the floor on what he can do by putting him in this offense and the architecture of their offense.
Okay, we disagree on whether we're seeing a durable, I don't know that I would call it a leap, but a step forward for DJ. Where are you on Cam Ward, who was maybe the, in. Yeah, I'm in too. I mean, are your NFL draft friends going to be in on him too?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's,
and I'm not even saying that as like, I'm saying that literally as I don't know. I'm not saying that as a doubt of his skill set at this point in time. I think Washington State's offense, those receivers are, boy. Let me tell you something. Washington's got its own receiver room that's pretty stocked, but Washington State's got something here. And let me tell you something.
Well,
if your slot corner and your safety on the inside aren't ready to rock against Washington State, you are going to have a bad time against the Cougars. They're feisty up front, and I get that, but the way they absolutely roasted Oregon State with different ways of getting the ball to slot receivers was pretty cool on Saturday night.
Yeah, it's a different guy every week right now for Washington State, which brings up a point It's funny. You talked about how you think the line play has improved at a couple of these schools, and I think it has. But one of the things that we know about Western recruiting over the last 10 years is that it has gotten harder, and it ebbs and flows to an extent, but it's gotten harder to find beef. It's gotten harder to find good line play in the historic Pac-12 footprint that will soon be, God, the Big Ten and Big 12 footprint. And like, I look at teams like USC, which I think has improved in this area, but is not a bunch of bullies in the way, certainly on defense. I think the offensive line's gotten better, and Marshawn Lloyd's production is a testament to that. But USC is not a line play team. I don't think that Washington, with the injuries that you talked about, is going to be a line play team as the season goes on. But like, if you look at playing to your regional strengths, which in this part of the country tends to mean receivers, cornerbacks, even quarterbacks, so a lot of these guys are transfers, like USC, Wazoo, UW, dude, three teams might have like 12 NFL receivers scattered amongst them. And like, that's hard to compete with.
Right, but we've never really lacked for fast guys out there. Like, we've never really, that's never been the case.
It's just crescendoing now.
Sure, and but I think the story here is them embracing what modern football is, modern college football is. It's Oregon going to get Bo Nix, who is as Auburn as any Auburn man has ever Auburned, mm-hmm. right? It's Oregon State, and I know DJ Uiagalelei is originally from this part of the country, but like, it's sort of, they all did the reverse, right? Like, Bryce Young, there's no reason why Bryce Young shouldn't have been USC's starting quarterback, for instance, right? Where Bryce Young grew up and where Bryce, there's no reason why CJ Stroud is Ohio State's starting quarterback and not USC's starting quarterback, or not Oregon's starting, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So we say this a lot about coaches at G5s in Florida and G5s in Texas, where they kind of, you do all the recruiting on the front end, the guy goes somewhere else, and then, and I'm saying it in a little bit different way, but like, and then the guy realizes that the winter in Minnesota is cold and he's not really playing, so he comes home. And in a little bit of a different way, these West Coast schools have done that. Now it's at a higher level, and they've sort of said, hey, it hasn't turned out how you thought it would in X power school or Y power school. Why don't you come here where we built an infrastructure that can play to your strengths? And when you don't have to, because when you bring transfers in, we joke about the free agency aspect of it. But one thing I think people don't realize is like Spencer Rattler told me, and yes, Spencer Rattler had a relationship with Shane Beamer that went way back. But like, Spencer Rattler told me, like, he never stepped on campus in South Carolina. And that's not rare at all, right? If you build a relationship, you get to play a recruiting game that is substantially different, where you get to say, son, you don't care about the facilities. Like, you've been in the facility. Like, you don't have to be wined and dined. Right? Transfer recruiting is not a wine and dine expedition. Like, transfer recruiting is you selling your organization and your system and showing the kid, you have played at a college level. This is what we think you can do for us. Unless drop a bag, here's our two waterfalls in the facility.
And that's, I agree that that's different for transfers, especially because when you're a year, two, even three into your college experience, time is more of the essence to play quickly. I think it's still a little easier to sell a prep recruit on give it a minute and then you'll be the guy here. But if it's been a minute and you're still not the guy, then it's less about the iPad in the locker and the waterfall, which, by the way, everyone has the iPad in the locker now. It's more about what can you do for my development as a football player. And I think that makes sense. But it is funny, Richard, because like in a matter of less than a year, like, Caleb Williams is going to be in either Arizona or Chicago. Wow. And probably. And like, USC is going to go back to doing what they've done. Like Malachi Nelson is a California kid who is going to be their quarterback, presumably. I guess you never know for sure if Lincoln doesn't like what he sees in practice this year. But like they're presumably going to go back to doing things at quarterback the way that USC did things at quarterback for like 50 years before getting into this
I think, yeah, and remember, like, I don't – like, Lincoln can do both, right? They went Baker Mayfield to Kyler Murray to Rattler, but then they – like, they recruited both Rattler and Williams.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like no. – he can do either way.
He can do both. I would agree. But I don't want to overlook this, that, like, a significant part of the Pac-12 being up at this moment and unfortunately it's going to become the Big Ten's gain soon – is that USC just woke up, man. You know, like USC just stopped, fucking around and got Lincoln Riley. And you're never going to have Lincoln Riley and not be one of the best teams in college football. It's not going to happen. Despite his more snake-like qualities in a lot of ways, it's just not going to happen that you're not going to score a lot of points and win games. I'm still like curious about, I mean, and if Godfrey were here, I think he would do this. He would be very impassioned about this, but like, I'm still curious because I don't think that Heritage Hall insularity and arrogance ever completely goes away. Like you're still a culture. You still have things happening here that are a lot at any given time. And it's only been months since the athletic director resigned in disgrace after it turned out they did a shitty job vetting this guy. So like there will always be drama here. And I think that it's naive to think that it will never again bleed into the competence of their football operation. But USC woke up. And I don't want to say it raises all boats, but it changes the way it changes the way you look at this league.
It does. I'm sorry if you're a Utah fan and you don't want to hear that. It does.
It's an interesting argument. I think it raises the boat for interesting college football as a whole. And we do this once a year, so we might as well get out of the way now. I think it's good when there's a power on the West Coast, and historically there's just one. I'm not sure how much it does for Utah.
Well, no, I don't think.
But I think it is good for general national interest in the enterprise of college football, which is not a monolith and which makes evaluating specific teams that it's good for challenging.
Oregon. Now, it's been Oregon. It's been USC in the last decade, whatever. I think Oregon has a pretty good claim to also being a power on that West Coast. And Oregon's funny, man. Like it's Oregon's national brand is one thing. Then you actually go to Eugene and you actually say, like, Oregon's not a big school. Like it's a fine. It's not, you know, Stanford's, it's not 5,000 kids, but like Oregon is not this, like Oregon has not done the like nationwide, you know, pulling students that like an Alabama has done, for instance, right? Like, Oregon isn't blown up as far as that's concerned. Some of that has to do with Oregon as a university. Like Oregon doesn't have a med school, which I found fascinating when I learned that over the weekend.
Interesting.
They also, they don't have a med school. There's some weird stuff with like the institution in and of itself. But like, I think that, it's just funny that Oregon has this national brand that is what it is. And then you go there and it's just a little different. And I don't think it's in a bad way. It's just funny, like finally going on campus and like seeing it for the first time in person.
Yeah. You go to some breweries while you were up there.
Oh yeah. Come on now.
Did you walk among some rolling green hills?
I will say that underrated stadium backdrop situation at Autzen. We always talk about the BYUs. We always talk about the Colorado. Incredible stadium backdrop at Autzen. And I do, it's going to be interesting how Autzen holds up when Michigan fans and Ohio State fans and Penn State fans start coming to town.
Are you worried about the architecture of those bridges that they walk on? Too many people.
Well, now I'm worried about, like, we need to get some more premium seats in here because we're not just bringing the 1,500. There were not any, like, in the grand scheme, right? Oregon Stadium's like 54,000, which is about a decent size. No problem, no qualms there. Loud as you'd like. That definitely lived up to the billing. But there were, like, no Colorado fans. Like, Colorado didn't bring their band. And the amount of Colorado fans that were there were, a lot of them were wearing Coach Prime sweatshirts, which is its own discourse. We'll have it another day.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, Michigan's gonna bring some folks.
You know,
Ohio State's gonna bring some folks. It's different than Cal in town.
There's a bar really close to me where I just moved in Los Angeles that is clearly a Colorado bar. They've got signs up everywhere that say we're a Colorado bar. And I want to go in there and just ask, so like, is this new? Like, did we decide that we're a Colorado bar this year? Were we previously a Colorado bar? Now, I also, when I lived in Washington, D.C., lived around the corner from a Colorado bar. So Colorado bars might just find me. I'm not saying that it's a new Colorado bar, but it did cross my mind. Richard, as this league spins forward and, you know, plays out the remaining 8-9 weeks of this season, like, you just said you think there are 3 playoff adjacent teams. I think if the term is playoff adjacent, I think there's 4. And because I'm wish casting, hey, let's leave Wazoo in there too until they lose a game, and let's see what kind of run they can make. We do this a couple times a year. I like to call it show and tell. The most interesting thing that you notice, or that one of us notices, as we watch the really good looking Pac-12 teams. And by the way, I want to also throw in that we haven't, so like Arizona State is bad. Stanford is really bad.
Yeah, Stanford's bad.
Cal is improved, but I think is going to probably run out of real estate. They've scored, against Auburn, they scored 10 points, and their offense against non-North Texas teams has not been very good. I don't think it's going to happen for Cal in the way that I'd hoped. We haven't mentioned Arizona either, which I think is a much improved outfit, again, under Jed Fish, and seems like their defense is not the disaster site that it had been. But if we go to the teams that we think might be able to win this league, or at least scare some people in this league, most aptly, what jumps out to you about, let's start with the Washington Huskies.
So this is really funny because I think that Ryan Grubb made an incredible career decision to stay at Washington and not go to Alabama to the extent that he talked about, with Alabama about that offensive coordinator job. I think it's pretty clear that Ryan Grubb's offense would not look like this at Alabama.
Don't have the guys?
Well, you don't have your guys. You run Nick Saban's offense at Alabama, but you don't have your guys is the most applicable point. There's 3 NFL wide receivers on the field for Washington. There might not be 1 at Alabama, but there may be 1.5 at Alabama. Sure, they would have gotten the run game going, Lord knows, which I do think Alabama is going to do here with the, you want to talk about design quarterback runs. Jalen Milroe, friend, I got your mandate for the rest of the season. But Washington's he's got this guy in Penix who, and because Kalen DeBoer obviously had him in Indiana, they know what he can do well. And I think that what I am curious to see with Washington is how that interior offensive line holds up. You know, we're probably not going to figure that out until the Oregon game in a couple weeks. But the people discount what internal, this is something that we talk about a lot. People discount what internal pressure can do to a quarterback. I'm not talking about edge pressure. Edge pressure is sexy. Edge pressure is fun. Everybody knows.
Pressure up the middle.
But pressure up the middle does things to quarterbacks, changes footwork, speeds up delivery, and as far as deep balls are concerned with Washington's offense, when Michael Penix's delivery is significantly sped up, I wonder what that does to accuracy overall, especially when you're throwing a lot of deep balls. Then there's the other hand of like kind of fearful about what happens on the day when some of the deep balls may not hit when you're in some adverse weather situations or what have you. I think Washington's offense is great, great. And I'm excited to watch it continue over the course of the season. And this is I think a lot of the, and this kind of goes back to what you were kind of getting at, Alex, is I think a lot of the bit was concerned with the Pac-12 on the field shooting itself in the foot by its best teams losing two by mid-October, right?
Right. You lose now, again, to Arizona State or to Washington State or whatever. Yeah.
Like dumb loss territory and or the non-conference loss in weeks one and two. And now, you know, obviously, as you mentioned earlier, you have the great irony of the Pac-12 shooting itself in the foot off of the field and tanking the whole thing.
You do. USC is interesting to me in a lot of ways. Obviously, it's USC. I think that right now I prefer Washington on the whole to USC, but the USC offense is a higher floor outfit than the Washington offense because of what you just talked about. Because of the injuries up front for Washington. I think it's basically impossible that USC's offense at any point this year for more than maybe one down game, if everyone gets food poisoning, like Michael Jordan in Salt Lake City, can the USC offense not be amazing? It just is what it is. I think maybe the underrated part of it is that they also run the ball really well. Marshawn Lloyd is having a hell of a year. And they're blocking for him.
Remember, that's how that offense is built. You built the bones of the offense on a run play.
Yeah, that's how it was.
Counter.
Yeah,
it was Oklahoma. Yeah.
It was a little less that way last year. I think in part because of what he had when he got there.
Yeah, and they've switched out. They've swapped out some screen game for some run game, and vice versa. Yeah. Here, over the last couple years.
They have. I don't even know who their number one receiver should be considered. Like it could be one of three guys. Like they have Mario Williams, they have Zachariah Branch, they have Brendan Rice. Dorian Singer, who came in from Arizona, one of the best receivers in the country, is like fifth or sixth in target share and yards right now. He's played four games. I mean, it's just like to call it an embarrassment of riches that they have on offense doesn't even do it. But it is just fun to watch. It's pretty to look at.
But Alex, both USC and Washington have, I think both USC, look, and I'm gonna, like, I don't think you can't blame Washington for the fact that Michigan State is an absolute smoking crater and fired its coach 4 days before you played them. Okay, that's not your fault.
No.
But they have been able to, I think, build hype, both of these teams, by building hype by basically not playing anybody. I mean, you look at, there's a lot of 4-0 teams, and you look at a lot of these 4-0 teams, and you look fine tooth comb. This is not just a Pac-12 thing. You look fine tooth comb on what a lot of these 4-0 teams have played. Hey, it's September in college football.
Yeah.
And you're like, whew.
No, I think there's 20. I think there's 26 unbeaten teams right now or something to that effect. And everyone understands that that's just kind of how it is. Richard,
right, but yeah. What I'm saying is, like, in a lesser Pac-12, like, they would have gaffed one of those games. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a taking care of business factor here by its good teams, for its good teams here, that I don't think we should sort of, poo-poo to an extent here. Like, you take care of business, Washington and USC.
Agreed. Agreed. I will note that Michigan State's defense, as well as Cal's defense, are not the smoking craters that their offenses are, but nor are they.
I think they are.
But okay, maybe they are. But they are also not, for sure, they are not also like amazing top of the country units.
No.
It is funny in USC's case. USC, as it stands right now, is not going to play a top 80 SP plus defense in their first six games. But then everyone else that they play. Then everyone else that they play in the back half of the year is top 55 or better, including a handful of top 25, five top 25s at the moment. So like we will see with USC. The thing that we will also see about is that USC additionally hasn't played an offense with a pulse yet, but has resuscitated or has given life to Arizona State, to a San Jose State that I don't think is very good, and that it's been a while since they won the COVID year in the Mountain West. They have given up 28 twice this year so far. they did fine. They did what they more or less should do against Nevada and Stanford defensively. But Richard, I mean, like you say, I'm an LA guy now. I can't believe, I mean, I'm not, I don't deserve it yet. It's been not enough time. But I did watch the entirety of the late USC game the other night. And like, they're lucky that most people were asleep while that was happening. What is a defensive coordinator's responsibility in teaching tackling, in your opinion?
I think that there's a level of physicality that you have to imbue into your defense. And I think like the obvious example is Georgia, right? Like Georgia's tackling, Georgia's physicality is something that jumps off the screen when you watch Georgia play, mm-hmm. right? Like when you get hit, you go down when Georgia tackles you, right? I think that is not exactly the case when you watch USC film. And so how do you imbue that? Well, you have what Georgia calls Bloody Tuesday, where their Tuesday practices are strap it on, baby, and we're going. And we're going against NFL talent, at least on defense. So you ask how you do that. You imbue that in everything that you do on defense. And I know that that has been, I should say, I don't know that that has been the case at USC.
This could be the year. I sound incredibly dismissive of it, and I am, because it's been a lot of years of like certain people in the coaching community, most prominently the head coach at USC, discussing their defensive coordinator, Alex Grinch, as something that he has yet to be. But if you're as smart as you say you are, like, it can't look the way that it's looked in half of their games so far against offenses that are not good and or are badly hurt as you go up and down those depth charts. Richard, a team that has no physicality problems whatsoever and probably takes cues from Dan Lanning's old boss is Oregon. They thump. They are physical.
Mm-hmm. And I think that Oregon, there is something very telling about the way Oregon beat Colorado, and it's not just what Dan Lanning said. You know, it they didn't just beat Colorado, they erased Colorado for four quarters. Like, there is, get them down, keep them down, don't let them up there. You know, Oregon pretty much did everything they wanted to on offense in that game. I think that, first of all, Bucky Irving, like, rocks, man. Like, awesome player. Awesome player of a running back of that size to be able to do some of the things that he did is pretty cool. But there is a, like, maybe Dan Lanning's got that dog in him, and I mean that Georgia Bulldog in him, with some of this stuff. And obviously we know that Dan Lanning is really sharp with fourth down math, and maximizing his chance to win. He's not a coward on fourth down. He knows when to take calculated risks. And I'm not even talking about the punt inside his own 20-yard line, which is, you know, that is a commentary on what you think about your opponent.
The fake punt. Else. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, also, if you look at, now this is 100% a propaganda video that Oregon produced to make Oregon look tough, but it hits. You've probably seen it. Oregon had cameras, microphones all over the place for that Colorado game. I think they might have used some footage from Colorado before the game.
They use Colorado.
Shiloh Sanders from Colorado is like at midfield yelling over at Colorado or at Oregon's players, like, why y'all so little? We're going to run over your fucking asses and y'all, coach. And you get Tosh Lapoy, who I forget how big this dude is. He's the defensive coordinator at Oregon. I thought he's a strength coach. Just like grimacing the zone players, like, it's not worth your attention, man. And obviously everyone's seen the landing clip of him. You know, we talk with our pads, playing for wins, not clicks. Like, these Oregon guys, yes, like, this is, they are to some extent hamming this up for their players, for the cameras, probably, but they might be SEC. Like, they might be serious. Like, they might eat tape for breakfast, and like, it just might mean more to them, like that particular Oregon staff, which would make sense because of where the respective people on that staff work. Like, they have a certain meanness about them that is like the good side of the stereotypical SEC thing that I think is notable, even with the understanding that they're trying to look a certain way for cameras.
It's sort of that, like, be ruthless. Like, be ruthless. Like, I do think, and I think I said this on Sunday, like, I do think, like, Dan Lanning and that coaching staff were offended at the concept that Colorado could come in there and not even just beat them, stay with them. Like, that's the thing. Like, again, we've talked about this. They were proving a point on Saturday. They game planned for that game like they needed to prove a point. Like, they needed to remind the country who's serious in this. And I do think there is something very telling about getting a team to play with a chip on its shoulder that wears color-changing cleats and fancy uniforms every week. Like, that is a hell of a parlor trick by Oregon's coaching staff. You know, Mario tried to do it too. Like, it's how do we take the branding of this program and not let it overshadow the things that we need to do to win football games at a high level, at a consistent level, to the level that we want, not just, you know, 9 or 10, but 11 or 12. That's the parlor trick here that they've got to pull.
Richard, I think that the best coach in college football, other than Nick Saban and Kirby Smart, is Kyle Whittingham. Thoughts, feelings, emotions? How does that land with you?
Pure football?
Yeah.
Yeah, pure football coach. Yeah, ball man. Coaching. I mean, like, the Utah comes into games with a plan. Utah comes into games with a unique ability to tie your right hand around your back and make you beat them with the left hand for the most part. You know, and that's what I think Utah's been really great at. But you can't look at this offensive situation with optimism moving forward here unless they get something back. Like, Cam Rising, I don't know if he doesn't trust the knee or whatever. As I understand it, he's been cleared to play, but he has not yet. They got to figure that out. Because you're going to get... And I know that everybody is going to look at the Pac-12 championship game and say, last year, and say, oh, well, Utah just beat him up in that game. Like, do you remember the first time they played USC?
Right. They had to escape. They had to escape.
Right.
Yeah.
That game was not 21-7.
No.
Like, I don't have Utah's schedule here. I'll pull it up in front of me as far as how it goes the next, but like, I think they're going to win on Friday night because I think they're, you want to talk about tying the hand around the back. I do think they're going to try to make DJ Uiagalelei play left-handed, and I do think they're going to end up winning that game, even though they are an underdog.
Here's the thing. They've got a few weeks until it gets really hairy. They have a bye week. They have Cal. They don't play USC and Oregon till weeks 8 and 9.
But they have those two teams in a row, and then it's 3 out of 4 when they go USC, Oregon, Arizona State, and then Washington. Like, in one of those games, you are going to have to score.
But like, here's the thing, Richard. And it might not be, but the cavalry might be coming. Like, I don't know Cam Rising is going to play. I don't know when Brant Keithy is going to play. And it's not just them, by the way. It's Micah Pittman didn't play last week. Jaquindon Jackson, their running back, who is good, got hurt in the game last week. They have linemen on both sides of the ball who have not played in weeks or at all in the season. It's like 8, 10, 12 contributors who just aren't playing right now for Utah. And it's a short season in college football. Like, remember, this thing, as we all know, flies by faster than you wish it did.
Like, we're a third of the way through.
Like, it's going, and like, they just might never be healthy. And I agree that if they don't get healthy, at some point, the foundation is going to give out, despite everything that I think about Whittingham. Like, this dude is a menace. Like, he is as good at this as anybody, but at some point, and Whittingham has said this, he has said this to me. I used to interview him somewhat regularly. College football is about recruiting. It is about your players. And if they have the half of the second string on the field all season, like, it is eventually going to catch up with them, especially this year in this conference. But credit where it's due that, like, even without a very functional offense so far, they're 4-0. Jonah Ellis, the edge defender, is a complete nightmare. Dante Moore is going to see him in his dreams for a long time. Look, like, they've
nobody.
They're doing it.
Right. nobody's going to have any problem with Utah on defense, how they play. I, for God's sakes, stick that in a corner. But like it, I look at those three teams that they're going to have to play, and in one of those games, they are going to have to score. You cannot just sit on all three of those offenses. Maybe you can bludgeon USC like you did in the Pac-12 championship game last year. All right. What are you going to do about Washington? Like, eventually one of those teams, you are going to have to stay with one of those teams. And that's where I come with, like, that cavalry better come back, or that's when it catches up with them. And again, you say they have time. They do have time. They have time to heal up. They have time to get back.
A bit.
But
a bit. Yeah.
It's got to happen.
Yeah, a bit. Utah's, like, strength and conditioning staff and team doctors are, like, the wild card in the Pac-12 race this year. Maybe not fair. I understand how injuries work. You can't always heal people in 2 or 3 weeks. But let's see how Utah's medical shake out. On the other side of that game, Richard, what did you make of where UCLA is at the moment against an opponent that sort of just, as the game went on, physically overwhelmed them?
Yeah, I thought UCLA was going to be better than that. You know, I thought UCLA had more in the tank physically to square up with Utah. And look, it was a 14-7 game, but like UCLA's problem isn't really moving the ball. UCLA's problem is finishing drives. UCLA is terrible as far as amount of times they get in the red zone. Like, they're fine efficiency wise in the red zone. They just don't get there a ton. That's a problem for them. It's taking advantage
just nothing
of
scoring drives. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's not going to get it done, like, especially when you get into the thick of this Pac-12 season again against teams that are going to score.
Yeah, I'm excited about what Dante Moore is going to eventually be, but he's a true freshman, and this is a good league, and it's a tough shake. I think that UCLA and Chip have all the reason in the world to be patient in this case. Like, DTR came in with almost as much hype or as much hype as Moore has come in with, and took him some years to even be decent and like 4 or 5 to finally be good. And I don't think it's going to take that long for Dante, but this is a hard year for him given the environment that they are playing in. Richard, Wazzu excites me a lot. Like, you talked about their receivers. They got 4 good ones. Lincoln Victor in the slot. Josh Kelly, Kyle Williams. Those two were the big guys last week. Kelly is this kind of outside burner guy who's very difficult for college cornerbacks to handle. And Carlos Hernandez. Cam Ward, I think, has made the leap. Like, I think everyone already understood that the upside was there because of what he was at UIW. When he was the best quarterback in all of FCS a few years ago. But he looks like a different guy in ways that are kind of hard to, for me, like, not as a quarterback evaluator by trade, to pinpoint. Like, he just looked a little bit halting last year, like awkward almost. Like, you could see the flashes, but it just wasn't completely there. And now, with Ben Arbuckle, who we've talked about coming over from Western Kentucky, where their offenses had been very good the last couple of years, seems like there's been a decline there this year without him. That's another point in his favor. They're just cooking. Like, it's funny. Like, they're cooking in a way that isn't entirely non-Mike Leachy. Like, it's a different offense, but it's also...
Remember, scoring a bunch of points.
No, I don't even just mean that. I mean, in terms of their... It's not Leach levels, but their preference for the pass over the run, the amount of 4 wide receiver sets, like it's a little Leachy, a little bit. It's not the pure uncut stuff, but they're fun. And I don't think that Washington State can win this conference. Like, it just feels far-fetched to me. But like, could we be looking at a 10-win Wazzu? I think that's in the realm of possibility. Obviously, I'm rooting for it because I think the agenda this year is for Wazzu and for this next team, Oregon State.
Of note for Washington State, they do duck Utah and USC. But then again, obviously yeah. they play Washington, and then they play Oregon as well. So it's not, you don't duck everybody. I don't think you can duck anybody by just schedule function of a deep league, but that is something to note.
Also I remember Washington that they've already beaten up on Wisconsin too. Pretty good.
Yeah, but, and I don't want to dismiss that win because it's a great win, but like, that's a Wisconsin team that doesn't know what it is.
No, I agree.
You know what I mean?
But they like beat them.
And sure, yes, yeah. you did the job. As far as Oregon State, you know, I talked about that earlier, and what they're doing on offense to maximize DJ Uiagalelei and is good is noteworthy. I do worry though, especially about against a Utah team this weekend. You know, I do worry about what that is. I do worry about how he's able to get over a feisty, fast, an aggressive defense that Utah's going to bring to the table.
Yeah, reasonable concerns. It's never easy if you are Wazoo and you are Oregon State, because you have a little bit less of kind of a natural recruiting advantage than every other team in this conference. And now, excuse me, and now the world's even a little bit more stacked against these two. So, like, I would love it if we could find ways to get both of these teams to 10 wins. I would settle for one, which is what we got last year when Oregon State did it. But let's see. It's been, I think, a really fun first 4 weeks of this league playing. I'm excited to see what happens when these teams more frequently, as they did last week, start to play against each other. Richard, nice home field apparel hoodie. I like what you're rocking today. You want to show it to the YouTube crowd? Thank you. Yeah, very nice.
Shout out to our friend Josh at Homefield, who I borrowed this off of for the live show so that I wasn't wearing the same Homefield apparel long sleeve as Godfrey. But then, you know, things happened. He left, I left, and now I have it. So I kind of have Josh, like I kind of boyfriend co-opted Josh's Homefield sweatshirt. So now both me and I believe Godfrey have done this with a Homefield hoodie.
Yeah, Godfrey did that very thing to me. And at our DC show, took one of my prized home field apparel crew necks. Fortunately, I have a couple more pieces of home field merch, but absolutely go to homefieldapparel.com. Use the promo code SCD20 for 20% off your first order. Home field stuff speaks for itself at this point, but because we are paid advertisers, I guess we should provide a specific testimonial. I'm in my Michigan home field right now. Don't know why I decided I was going to be a Wolverine today, but they are simply the best, the top of the market. If you are looking for cool collegiate apparel, to put on for your school or to be a mercenary like me and put on for a bunch of schools, depending on what you think looks good, feels good that day. I'm also excited, Richard, that I'm going to be with Homefield and with a lot of Georgia Bulldogs, both fans and former players, during Georgia's homecoming weekend this year. I've actually never been to Athens. I need to check places off the list for as long as we've been covering this sport that I just have not gotten to for one reason or another. And I'm excited that on the Friday night of Georgia's homecoming weekend, which is November 3rd, I'm going to be in Athens at the Graduate Hotel. There's a home field merch pop-up at the Foundry in Athens on that Friday night. And we're going to be there doing kind of a panel discussion as well with some dogs starting at 5 p.m. About various UGA things. I'm excited to do it, to be there with home field for that event. It's going to be a wonderful time. And I'm excited to get taken around Athens by Josh from Homefield, who you just mentioned, who is a dog. And he's such a dog that he even goes to Georgia basketball games, which really can't believe it. Richard, what time is it?
It's time to taste it.
I'm happy for Steven that he's not here today, so he didn't have to deal with
that.
Oh, I got
something.
But I like it.
There was a different taste it ready. And he's not here this week. Don't worry. We'll debut it next week.
Also, Richard, I should say as I go backward that if you go to Homefield's Twitter account or to mine, you can find the information for that Athens event. There's a, you know, an event page where you can reserve a spot and all of those good things. It is free. It'll be a great time. But yes, the tasting menu, as I fill in that little bit of information that I forgot to put out. Thursday night, I think the most interesting one here is Jacksonville State at Sam Houston. That's at 7. Sam Houston was one of the best teams in FCS, though they fell off a bit last year, in part because of this FBS transition. We expressed some worry before the year that they might not be physically turnkey for FBS the way that, for instance, James Madison was last year. they have one touchdown and 10 points in three games. And they are 133rd out of 133 in offensive SP+. Jacksonville State, also up from FCS, looks better. Also pretty bad on offense, but seems to have a little bit more all the way around so far than Sam Houston. So I would say watch this if you're curious about teams making the move coming up.
Friday night, Louisville and NC State. Louisville, as you have noted, 4-0. How about it? NC State really, really got away with one last weekend. I think NC State is...
Yeah, tell me about that. I don't know if that one even made the hurry up. I don't think that one was at the top of my radar, aside from, oh, damn, they almost lost to UVA.
No, they got away with one with penalties. Like, Virginia literally gave them the game with penalties. Virginia basically had some penalties.
Yeah, you had this. Yeah.
Their
yeah.
last touchdown drive that gave NC State the a favorable field positioning on the ensuing kickoff. They were then able to move the ball and were then able to kick the field goal that had a leaping penalty, and then that made that field goal a chip shot field goal.
Bit far.
So, NC State did get away with one on Friday night. But let's find out here about Louisville. Let's find out for real about Louisville.
Yeah. So far, Jack Plummer and Jawar Jordan, quarterback running back duo, having both career years, and things looking very Jeff Brahmy in terms of the quick offensive buildup here, which actually I didn't notice until recently because I think I just assumed it took him a year at Purdue to really get that offense revved up. It may not be taking him a year at Louisville. Granted, he's taking over a team that was better, that was a bowl team last year, than what he took over when he got to West Lafayette. Utah and Oregon State. This is also on Friday night. We have just talked at some length about both of these teams. Utah isn't healthy yet, and as such, I think it's a toss-up game. I think Oregon State's even like a 3.5-point favorite in this game.
Yeah,
it's like and, 3.5. You know, it shouldn't like, be considered a big upset if Oregon State pulls this off.
But I think Utah's going to win this game outright just because I don't – like, I'm going to take this defense against DJ Uiagalelei in this spot.
We're going to see. Yeah, I think that Utah pretty heavily recruited DJ all those years ago when he wound up going to Clemson. So it's sort of a full circle opportunity for both sides of that game. Cincinnati and BYU also Friday. Richard, the Cincinnati offense ain't it. Desmond Ritter is not walking through that door to replace Emory Jones. And unless BYU gives the ball up a bunch as they did against Kansas, I think BYU at home is in great position to win this game.
Yeah, I you're a transfer on your third stop, man. And it's not just him. Plenty of them in college football. But there's a reason you're on your third stop.
Yeah. Are there any big third stop quarterback transfer success stories? Third stop ones. There are a million second stop ones.
Second stop. Yeah, I own third stop off the top of my head. No, I'm sure somebody will tweet us and tell us one.
Yeah,
we just or there are.
We're just remembering some guys here. Please do. Let us know the best third stop guys. Saturday, early slate, Clemson and Syracuse. This is 11 a.m. Central Time. Cuse has been a pain in the ass for Clemson for like 5-6 years now. I don't think that it's a good matchup for Cuse here.
They have played some weird.
They have. And they were running
weird fucking football games.
Oh, and Syracuse has also just so far played teams that are not of Clemson's front caliber on defense. And like, you know, they have run the ball great against Colgate and Western Michigan and Purdue and Army. Clemson is a little different animal. And I wonder if, especially without Aronde Gadsden, they're best receiver, probably. I think the most talented deep threat. I don't know. I think Clemson should figure this out, but of course, Clemson is no longer top of market. So let's see.
Well, don't take Clemson not being top of market for. I know these teams play weird games, but like, don't take that for like again from off season. Clemson's defense was not the problem. Clemson's defense is not the problem.
Nope.
Clemson's defense did not give up 30 points on Saturday. Remember, one of those was a fumble six against Florida State. Again, not worried about Clemson's defense. Think Clemson's defense will do the job here.
Yeah, fumble six and overtime to score. You know, that's yes. 14 sort of points that you shouldn't hold against Clemson's defense from an evaluation perspective of their caliber, though they did lose the game. Arkansas A&M at Jerry World. These teams play the same game every year. I'm sure they'll play the same game again this year.
Yeah, Max Johnson show for A&M at quarterback. Connor Wegman, not as bad as you think, but Connor Wegman is out. So, okay, all righty. Speaking of playing the same game, Florida and Kentucky about play the same game every year here since like Muschamp era. This is a close spread. Florida's lack of vertical passing game is going to get them beat at some point in time if they don't get vertical. Now, Florida does get offensive linemen back from the Tennessee suspension and proved against Tennessee in the Tennessee game that they can move the rock a little bit. Wisconsin South blueprint here. Kentucky, we know the deal with Kentucky. Is the offensive line good or isn't it? They haven't played a team with a pulse, and they got pushed to the brink by Eastern Kentucky, an FCS team. So, all right, Kentucky. I know that this on paper, I think, is a game Kentucky should win, but the 1.5-point spread, like either outcome does not surprise me here anymore.
No, shouldn't. Minnesota plays against Louisiana, hosts Louisiana in this early window on Saturday. And I don't think that they are going to lose, but be careful. Be careful for a team that just lost to Northwestern in excruciating fashion and has shown, frankly, nothing. Like, I think the better offense in this game is Louisiana's Sun Belt unit coming up to the Twin Cities. I think much more highly of the Cajuns' ability to move the ball and score points than I do of this post-Tanner Morgan, post-Mo Ibrahim Minnesota offense that just, like, has been – well, it's been terrible. Like, it's been terrible. I don't think that Ethan Kaliakmanis has it for Minnesota. Not yet. He could maybe develop into it. But I'm not all the way there to, like, pick the upset here, but it wouldn't be very surprising if I can put that in kind of that hedgy way. South Bama at James Madison. Some air out of the balloon for South Alabama. Because after crushing Oklahoma State, they went and lost a game they really should have had, both in terms of beforehand and during the game, against Central Michigan. JMU goes to 5-0 if they can hold serve at home. It appears that they have themselves yet another solid quarterback, Jordan McLeod, who replaces Tatsun Teo.
South Alabama is actually pretty efficient third down and finishing drives. So
yeah,
that's like...
Showed that in Stillwater.
Yeah, and that, you know, they polish it off there. Can JMU stick with them, particularly on offense? We know that I think they can put up points. Gonna have to. You're gonna have to keep pace. UAB Tulane. UAB is bad. Tulane is not bad.
Yep. The evidence is pointing in favor of the haters with Trent Dilfer. You know, like, it just looks bad. Like, UAB should never be... this is a program that shut down. Things can get bad there. Everyone knows they can get bad there.
It can get squirrely there.
It can get squirrely there. You know. But I think that given the stability that they now have, the facilities that they now have, where they reside, they should not be one of the worst teams even coming up into the American. And I think they might be. So monitoring that does not seem good for Trent Dilfer in UAB. USC, Colorado. Best offense USC has seen so far by a mile. I don't think there's any way Colorado can win this game, but I do think that they can score quite a few points. The problem is they're going to give up about a billion.
This should be a backdoor special as far as backdoor cover is concerned for Colorado. I think it's 21.5. The hook, enticing.
UVA, Boston College. This is at 1 p.m. Central on the CW. I think the loser here, which I think is going to be Boston College, takes the mantle of presumptive worst team in the Power 5 this season. Although Virginia Tech, the bottom of the ACC, is not a good scene right now. And Northwestern, but Northwestern won a game last week. It's ugly here. There was something to look forward to here in that both of these teams have been playing kind of wild men QB back there who just run around and like chuck it. Exactly. Thomas Castellanos for BC and Anthony Colandrea for UVA. I think Colandrea is back to the bench for UVA in this game. So
because he may or may not have lost in the game on Saturday or on Friday against NC State.
Look, reasonable. I'm just saying it would have been a little bit more fun if he were playing. Keep an eye on it.
There was a high level of yeet factor in this game. Penalty Super Bowl, by the way. Boston College, the most penalized team in the country. Virginia lost a game on Friday because of penalties.
Fair enough. This is the mid-afternoon slate. Baylor and UCF. Talk about a game that I now think will go differently than I would have thought it would go if you'd asked me a month ago to kind of play the schedule game. Like, Baylor sucks. They are good at all.
I don't think Baylor's the worst team in Power 5, but
they might be the worst team in the – I guess I'm not quite there yet that they're the worst team in the Big 12, but I'm also not dismissing that possibility.
No.
Like, West Virginia might be better than them. And West Virginia might be better than a lot of teams. Yeah.
Let's wait till Blake Shaping comes back to kind of fully bake that take. But right now, this is ugly. Ugly.
I am confused about what has happened here. It might be as simple as he's not there. Like, that might be it.
I think on offense, it's that simple because I do think Blake Shapen's a good player. On defense, and I think I made this point in one of our earlier, like, that defense is small. That defense took the soul out of the middle, and it was more than just Siaki Aka. Like, they had a backup who is also, or last year, who's also a good player and at least big enough to hold up. They're getting pushed around. They got put, and they knew Texas was going to push around. They got pushed around against Texas State in week one. Like, it's been there, man, and it's troubling. Now, if Shapen gets back and they can score some more points and they can fend some of these things off, okay, well, it's not that big of an issue. But right now, it is an issue.
I mean, it looks like a non-bowl team unless something drastic changes, so we'll see where they go. UGA and Auburn. Hugh Freeze still really going on about how impossible this game is because of what was left for him by Brian Harsin, which, again, might be true to some extent, but also, negging his current team quite a bit. He talked about how he played Kirby his first year in Athens, and it was a totally different situation with what he inherited from Mark Richt.
Did you see the clip where, like, he's given a press conference, and he was like, oh, Kirby won the national championship, like, early in his tenure. And he was like, I don't know when it was, like, maybe, like, he couldn't recall how many years. And then one of the reporters was like, oh, it was in his second year. Like, you could tell that Hugh was like insanely taken aback. Like, kind of tried to challenge the guy on whether it was actually Kirby's second year in which he made the national championship game. In one of those, like, John Boyce has a great YouTube video. In one of those, like, how many days of the week are there actually videos? It was actually pretty funny.
Also, part of the deal here is, like, yes, we all know that the cupboard was not left in a great place by Brian Harsin. Like, he was spectacularly bad at this job and really set Auburn back a while. But, like, whose fault is it that your quarterbacks this year are Peyton Thorne and Robbie Ashford? Like, I understand that they tried with Grayson McCall, but, like, he would have gotten eaten alive in this game too, for the record. I'm not sure what the path is to Auburn scoring. I mean, they might get a touchdown or maybe even two if they get frisky, but it's not going to be, like, you know, the afternoon that you want. And I think you just have to kind of take a long view, which I think most Auburn fans will. This will not be their day this afternoon.
I think it's a South Carolina part two situation where I'm sure Auburn will come out with a little razzle dazzle because that's Hugh's thing, and they will get at Georgia for a time, and then they won't.
Oh, I don't know that they're going to get out. Later. I don't know that they're going to get at him for a time. With which quarterback throwing? With which quarterback are they going to get after
them?
That's
fair.
Spencer Rattler, different deal. Different deal in that game. Houston and Texas Tech. Godfrey wanted to pass along that this is an anxiety bowl. Thoughts?
All right. Look, things can get squirrely in Houston real quick. I don't discount that at all. Texas Tech. They lost a quarterback. So it's like, what do you even take from this? I guess win if you're Texas Tech. Win the game.
Like, this was the thing that we wondered aloud about before the year is how does Texas Tech hold up morale-wise and program momentum-wise if the on-field starts to look more like what it almost always looks like for Texas Tech, because the first year was so optimistic in every way. I have read some of the reporting in The Athletic and elsewhere about the oil money that has flowed into Texas Tech and about the general tenor of excitement around Texas Tech right now. It is possible, especially with Tyler Shuck being hurt, I don't know his specific status, but he's at least banged up. It's possible that Texas Tech is going to be a guinea pig for what happens when, in a collective era, you have the money flowing and you have a really mobbed up in Texas head coach in Joey McGuire, and you have this recruiting infrastructure that's really important, but you lose a bunch of games. That could happen. It also might not. It's only been 4 games. It's been a month. But I do think that it's at least worth contemplating that Texas Tech's season could be a bit of a guinea pig about how the recruiting stays together in this moment, where it's not just about the things it used to be about, if the results don't improve. Keeping an eye on it. That's all we say. Kansas and Texas.
Texas is good. We are pro Kansas on this particular program.
But I don't see it here.
But Texas is good. And yeah. I do think Kansas, look, Jalen Daniels, you want to talk about running around and doing some things. Jalen Daniels will run around and do some things. I do think Kansas is going to give Texas a little bit more than they want in this game. But
yeah,
do expect cream to rise to the top eventually.
I do as well. I just feel much differently about Texas than I have felt about previous Texases. Michigan, yes, and yes, Nebraska. It's going to be pretty tough again for Nebraska.
You know exactly how this game is going to go.
It'll be a great atmosphere.
This game is going to go.
In Lincoln.
This game is going to go exactly like every other Michigan game has gone this season. You know what this is going to happen.
Yeah, but because it's at Memorial Stadium and it's going to be a big night and a big afternoon, and like it'll be a rollicking college football scene. It would be cool if Nebraska could land a few blows early before it gets to where I think it will get, which is out of hand. It can't be Jeff Sims. I don't know his health status going into this game, but you can't put that young man in that position given how it's gone. Like, I think Heinrich Harburg takes better care of the pigskin and has been harder to get on the ground. So I would go with him if I were Matt Rhule. Luke Reamer, the Nebraska linebacker, is a very good player, if not the best player on that team, is questionable.
They're going to win this game 38-10, just like they have won every other game.
Yeah,
basically.
That's where it will end up. But it would just, do you see life or do you not see life from Nebraska? That's kind of what I'm wondering about. Boise State, Memphis. I kind of think Memphis gets it done here and takes a nice 4-1 into the meat of conference play. They have some limitations. I don't know exactly how I feel about Seth Hennigan, but I don't think that Boise is going to throw it over them in the way that might be a weakness for that team. And I'm transitioning from being kind of a bear to kind of a bull on Memphis at the moment.
What changed for you there?
Well, they've just looked good. And I think part of it is that I have an also weirdly growing opinion of Mizzou, which they played competitively last weekend. I reserve the right to change my mind on this. This is, the thing about college football. It's a short season, and we talk about this thing for 52 weeks a year, and we only see games for 12, 13, 14 weeks a year. So, like, our opinions are going to evolve in real time, and we'll see if we boomerang back on Memphis at any point this year. But I think that right now it's looking like a good move that they didn't fire this guy, Ryan Silverfield, last year. Not trending in my favor, as I thought they should have at the end of last year. So gotta acknowledge it when we see it.
Hey, that's personal growth. It's impressive. Where are we at? LSU Ole Miss. This is the Minority Coach of the Week in a interesting schematic spot. Remember, Minority Coach of the Week is not an achievement award. It's not a portender or a predictor of success. It's just taking a minority coach in a certain schematic spot and saying, huh, that's interesting. I'm going to take Randall Joyner here, who is Ole Miss's defensive line coach. Young guy, But Ole Miss up front has been pretty damn good this season, to be honest with you. Even against Alabama, that ain't the reason they lost in that game. Young guy, this is, I think, his second full-time, his second room, in a sense, came over from SMU and has been doing a pretty good job there.
Richard, do you think that there's a chance that this is the first week of the year where everyone looks up and is like, oh, Harold Perkins, yeah, we remember him?
Yeah, I have not looked back and seen how they have played him the last couple weeks, and so I do need to do that. But yeah, it would be nice if you're LSU for that to be the case.
Iowa State and Oklahoma might be another very fun day for the Oklahoma Sooner defense. There haven't been a lot of them in my lifetime or in your lifetime, but they look good right now. And Iowa State, despite putting up a nice showing against Oklahoma State with the ball, is a juicy target for Brent Venables and the crew.
Oklahoma, I think, is really good at smoking bad teams, but then also will struggle with at least competent defenses.
Iowa State has that.
Right. That's what I mean. The next 2 weeks are where I got to see something from Oklahoma's offense. I do think Oklahoma's defense is getting adjacent to where you want it. But Oklahoma on offense against a defense with more than just a pulse, I got to see it. I got to see it.
Michigan State, Iowa. If you love one of these teams, bless you for watching. Otherwise, not on my list of fun for the weekend.
Notre Dame and Duke. I'm into Duke as a concept. But I do think it's about to step up a notch. And I'm a little concerned. This is a big spot game. This is in Durham. College Game Day is going to be there, and it's in Durham, right?
It's in Durham. Yep.
Okay.
And College Game Day has been to Durham a bunch, just usually the basketball show.
The other.
Yeah.
Yes, the other College Game Day. Yeah. I think Duke is really competent. I think Duke has been impressive. I'm not ready yet on Duke. I'm not ready. I will be ready. I don't even think you have to win in this game. I will be ready on Duke if they, you know, kind of keep it close, et cetera, but I'm not ready on Duke yet.
The thing about Duke that is tough for Notre Dame is that what Duke, I think, has done really well so far, and they punished Clemson in this way, is that, granted, Clemson probably contributed to it too, really hard to pull off explosive plays against this defense. Like, they have a good secondary, helped by the transfer portal, guys from Miami, guys from A&M, and like, Notre Dame has not found that gear for a while. And, you know, against Clemson, this hurt because they had to put these long drives together, and eventually they gave the ball away during a lot of these drives. Like, I don't think it's going to be a breakout passing game for Notre Dame. I mean, Sam Hartman saw it, but I don't think it's going to be the big shots, and they're going to have to figure out how to move the ball.
Right. I don't think they need to be. I don't think they need, like,
Audrey, if you're asking 40 times.
Yes, yeah. Literally. If you're asking Notre Dame to win a game where they have to just run like 10 play drive, seven passes, or sorry, 10 play drive, seven runs, that's how you have to skin the cat in this game, I think Notre Dame's going to be all right. That's the game Notre Dame wants to play. And again, it's not like Clemson didn't move the ball on Duke. That's not what happened against Duke. They just ended up throwing up on themselves when they got to that 10-yard line.
I am kind of in on Duke, but I agree that this is a lot to chew for them. South Carolina and Tennessee, neither of us really knows the deal with the Tennessee Volunteers.
I cannot figure Tennessee out, man. Cannot figure Tennessee out.
Let's leave it there. Let's see what we might learn about them in this game. San Diego State, Air Force. I think Air Force might be capital G good this year. But I want to temper myself because I think that about a month into last season, I also thought that might be the case. And I thought they might be a New Year's Six type team, and it just didn't come together. But they are very much themselves. Like, they have this good run game that takes a few yards at a time, stays on schedule, does not get ahead of it, but stays on it. And then they hit you with a couple of really brutal deep passes that connect, and they don't run the same version of the bone that Navy is running and that Army has largely abandoned. But I think they're the best academy team this year. And I also think that there is a real shot that they are the best team in the Mountain West. San Diego State, mentioned that already. Don't feel that way about them. I think the Air Force should drop them 2-4.
What's funny is on Friday night against San Jose State, they sure as hell look like the same flex bone option that Navy was, because they were moving the damn ball and they were under center.
And they do it though.
Yeah, they were doing the job. Well, I guess a good Navy is the point there.
But so, Richard, I want you to unpack this for me, because you have written this story literally for Sports Illustrated, and I think we've talked about it, but I want to understand it better. You have referred before, and Godfrey's referred before, to what Air Force does for a while now, being different than what Army and Navy did. And we know that Army is making changes. Like, in what respect is Air Force different offensively, like in the way that they try to skin the cat moving the ball?
I would say that I think they do something that looks a little bit more run game, Coastal Carolina-ish, or run game maybe what Army's kind of trending toward, which is essentially just do the business out of the shotgun, just not in the flex bone as much. Now, again, that San Jose, like the whole second half that I was watching that game, our Air Force was running the flex bone. So it's not like they can't, or it's not like they don't, but they were the first to kind of think outside the box of the three academies about what that offense could, should, and needed to be. And they've been doing that since Troy Calhoun's been there.
West Virginia, TCU, starting to wonder if Neil Brown is going to save himself, as we've talked about. I think on the TCU side of this, nice win for them in the Iron Skillet game against SMU last week, put their rival that they're no longer going to play kind of in its place. But it looks like a 7 or 8 win TCU team. They can't really find big. Where are the big plays? Here's why I say that. Where are the big, like, the missing of Quentin Johnston is acute. And I think it's more obvious than they miss Duggan, or they miss Kendre Miller, or Amari DeMercado. Like, I don't see the explosion. That's why I think they're probably like an 8-ish win team. But
I think some of that has to do with the quarterback.
Okay. Yeah. The quarterback play didn't help them in their lone loss today against the Colorado Buffaloes back in week one. But we'll see how Chandler Morris develops. And Richard, late, Washington, Arizona. It's on the Pac-12 network.
Woof.
We talked about the irony and the cruel irony of the conference. I don't know what is a crueler irony than Michael Penix Jr. and the fellas having a night, him further cementing his Heisman candidacy. Heisman candidacy. Further cementing his Heisman candidacy. This is why I try to write out my notes ahead of time. When I don't, I talk too much on this show and I twist my words. And most people are not going to see it because of where it is. Sad.
Heisman candy. Wrap it up.